tourist trap where beautiful young people looking for excitement are tricked, terrorized,
and welcome to the Cult Cinema Circle podcast. My name is Jesse, and I'll be your host. Now, on today's episode, we're going to head over to Slauson's Lost Oasis, and we're going to be covering a little movie from 1979 called Tourist Trap. Now, my experience with Tourist Trap is that I didn't actually watch it for the first time until probably like 2 years ago in March of 2022, and you're hearing this in like April of 2024, so I just watched this movie in March of 2024, but I had tangentially been aware of it, I guess, but then I finally watched it, and I watched it as part of the last drive-in movie marathon that Joe Bob Briggs, he was supposed to do the last one back in 2018, and I was getting around to watching some of those. And, you know, in this situation, it was fun to revisit this and to see it. Again, I had not seen it before, and this movie was kind of right up my alley. I like that kind of, like, weird, surrealist stuff every so often, and this movie is also, like, a little low-budget horror movie, which can also have my heartstrings as well, depending on how well it's done or, you know, the kind of passion that's behind it. There are some bad movies that are just out and out bad, but then there are some that are just charming enough, which I think this kind of falls under that for me at least. And yeah, I had a good time with it. I thought it was really creepy in some elements, and I think it's an early example of a low budget slasher, and I decided why the hell not cover it, especially since it's celebrating its 45th anniversary this year. So it came out 45 years ago, and I thought, why not cover it for the show? So as we normally do on the show, we'll be covering the production history, the figures of the movie, how was this received by critics and all that, and then we'll move into like a plot breakdown, all that fun stuff. So without further ado, let's get into it. So Tourist Trap was released March 14th of 1979, and it has about a run time of about 90 minutes. So there is like an 85 minute, I think, like cut of this that was used for TV and stuff like that, but the 90 minutes that I'm talking about is like the uncut version, because sometimes you'll see that distinction as well. So I think you can find the uncut version on like Tubi. If you're on Shudder, I think that's what's on there. So you watch whichever cut you want to, I guess. But just know there is a little bit of a difference, but not by much, I don't think. And then this was distributed by Compass International Pictures. I'm sure we'll talk about them a little bit. And then the budget is about $350,000. So this is a low budget horror film. And I didn't find any sort of box office information because I don't think it really came out in theaters like that, or at least at a time where we can have like comprehensive box office numbers that I could talk about. But I do think this movie did all right on like home video. And then as I've, you know, if you may already know this, but you may not know, this is actually a movie that is rated PG. So it definitely got like that 85 minute cut probably went on television and stuff. So like on Up All Night with Rhonda Shear and Gilbert Gottfried or something like that. So something that could be easily edited for television. I think Tourist Trap definitely got a lot of TV play back in the day, which is why it's in some people's heads and they're like, oh my God, I remember this movie as a kid or whatever. So I think that's kind of what that had. We're looking at about a 40% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics out of about 5 reviews, and then 47% with about 5,000 ratings from audience, and then a 3.1 out of 5 on Letterboxd. So it's kind of split. Some people like this movie, some people hate this movie. It all kind of depends, but you know, it is what it is. Again, I have a little bit of a soft spot for certain like low budget 80s or like late 70s, 80s movies, but then there are just some movies that are super bad that they're bad. And again, there's a fine line between like so bad it's good and then like just bad that it's bad, but it is what it is. So we got to talk about the crew a little bit. So David Schmoller is our director. He went on and did Puppet Master. And we'll talk a little bit more about him in particular, but that's really what he has been known for and has an interesting kind of little story about how he got here. And then the writer of this movie was J. Larry Carroll and then David Schmoller. And they are kind of just known for this movie of writing it. I don't think they went on and wrote a bunch of other things. The composer is kind of a notable dude, Pino Donaggio, a Italian composer. And if you watch this movie, you may be wondering like, I wonder why this sounds like the score from Literal Carrie from 1976. And that's because you're right, Brenda. He did do the music for that. So, I mean, yeah, he did that. He did Seed of Chucky's music. He also did Dress to Kill, a bunch of different scores. So I think he has since passed away, but he was such an icon. And I love his scores personally. And the score of this movie is a weird one, to say the least, but it's something I really love and appreciate. I think it's like so fun. And it really kind of sets this up as like a weird ass, it's, you know, late 70s movie. So I can get behind it. And then the editor of this movie is Ted Nicolau. He actually edited Butcher Baker Nightmare Maker, which I think is a fantastic movie. And it was on like Shudder. I think it might still be on Shudder, but if you haven't checked that out, it's fucking crazy. But it also has like a positive gay role model as well. And Susan Tyrell is like a goddamn icon as this crazy lady. So yeah, if you're at all interested and you never watched Butcher Baker Nightmare Maker, please do. But that's the editor of this movie who also edited that movie. And then, so we have the crew there. And then also, of course, this is a Charles Band movie, Full Moon feature kind of thing. So, you know, they do have the rights to it, which is why they did the uncut version or whatever. So we'll talk about that a little bit. And then the cast of this movie. So we have Jocelyn Jones. She's really only known for this movie. And honestly, she then became like a acting teacher and she's been able to be an acting teacher for people in Hollywood, which is really cool. I think she does a pretty good job here. You know, she definitely is able to sell the terror that is going on in this movie, as she's supposed to. And then Chuck Connors is our main guy. Spoiler, he's the villain of this movie, but he actually started his career as like a basketball player and then a minor league baseball player and then became an actor. So he was in like Soylent Green. He was also in Airplane 2, the sequel. And yeah, he was on TV and stuff back in the day. So, and then he was like the third choice for this movie. We'll get into that a little bit. Then you have Tanya Roberts. Tanya Roberts! If you want to laugh a little bit, look up Drew Drogi or Damiana Garcia. You'll find like these old World of Wonder videos. And Drew Drogi is really funny. He does a impression of Chloe Sevigny, but he also did an impression of Tanya Roberts. And it's like her being at Tahiti Village and also having this like weird contentious relationship with Damiana Garcia. And it was just very funny to me. And that's who I think of when I think of Tanya Roberts.
Have you ever said to yourself, God, I need a vacation, but where the fuck would I go? The Tahiti Village is probably for you. Hi, hello, I'm Tanya Roberts, and I don't have a lot of time. Located just 40 gorgeous miles off the Las Vegas Strip, Tahiti Village is a paradise, a paragon. It's just like Tahiti, but what the fuck would you know? You've never been to Tahiti. Right? Now, you might say to me, Tanya, hey, what about the flavors am I gonna be tasting? And I'll say, listen, we've got a lots of flavors at Tahiti Village. I'm talking about food, if you're confused. We're talking fresh cracked crab. We're talking flaky ham, creamy chicken, buttery, pillowy steaks. It's all there at Tahiti Village.
But you may know Tanya Roberts as she is Midge from That 70s Show. Pinciotti, that's her last name. I was thinking what her last name was, and then I was like, okay, yeah. But she was also in Charlie's Angels, and she's kind of the most famous person from this movie, to be honest. But, you know, yeah, she unfortunately passed away not too long ago, a couple years ago, but she's a fun one. She's got a brutal death in this movie, but yeah, that's Tanya Roberts. Robin Sherwood is in this movie as well. She plays one of the other girls. I think Eileen. She was in Death Wish 2 with Charles Bronson, but she was also in this film as well. Apparently she came from like a rich family and went to all the fancy acting schools like in London and stuff. And then ended up being in Tourist Trap. John Van Ness is another guy. He plays, I think, Jerry, or maybe the other guy. I don't think he plays Woody. I think he plays Jerry, because there's only two guys in this movie, really, that are not Chuck Connors. And he's actually in The Hitcher. Again, Jerry is kind of like a throwaway character a little bit. Like, he's kind of in here because he doesn't actually live until the end, unfortunately, but you think he does, but he doesn't. And, you know, he's the last man standing, if you will, except for Chuck Connors, but we'll talk about that. And then Dawn Jeffrey is Tina. She's the one who gets killed as part of the, like, she gets taken from the gas station and gets held up at this fucking tourist trap. She is actually in Mommy Dearest, funny enough. That's fun. But she didn't have like a ton of like other roles that I can think of or that I was able to really find. So that's kind of our main cast. Also, I don't know how, because I wasn't really able to corroborate this, so take it with a grain of salt, but apparently Linnea Quigley, our girl from Return to the Living Dead and, you know, Sorority Babies and the Slimeball Bullerama and Nightmare Sisters, she apparently is in an uncredited appearance as one of the mannequins in this movie. And you know what? I kind of believe it, maybe. It would make some sense. But yeah, so because this was shot in LA, so of course it makes a lot of sense to me. But that's a little bit about the cast of this movie, a little bit about the crew. But let's talk a little bit about how this movie came to be. So, as I stated, the screenplay for this movie was written by David Schmoller, the director, and J. Larry Carroll, the latter of whom pitched the idea of the film to producer Charles Band, who again is from Full Moon Features. Initially, Schmoller wanted to get John Carpenter to direct this film, but Carroll was unsatisfied with the financial agreements and opted instead that Schmoller should direct the movie. And then Carroll and Schmoller had previously pitched this to Samuel Z. Arghoff and Bruce Cohn Curtis, but were able to actually secure any sort of production agreement, so they had to keep moving on and on. So the original idea of this movie did not include the telekinetic powers for Davey. According to Carroll, the idea was actually proposed by Band, who insisted that it be implemented in the script. And the unfortunate thing about some executive producing type things is that, yeah, you sometimes have that control over the movie. Schmoller, though, he drew inspiration from like Alejandro Jodorowsky, who did El Topo, and like Louise Buñuel, who I believe also kind of influenced Takashi Miike in like Audition and stuff like that, which is kind of interesting. Which again, this movie also has this kind of weird off-kilter vibe to it, if you will. And also his just observations of store mannequins at like a JCPenney's department store. And I will say this, I mean, it's not like I go to the mall like that or department stores in general. I used to work in one, but I don't really like mannequins like that. I'm not a huge fan. So I totally understand how people who have that kind of fear would be like freaked the fuck out by this movie. Not that I think they're going to like kill me. I just don't like how they look sometimes, but that's just me. So then the casting of this movie. So the production does not have like a casting director or anything. So instead they had to use independent talent agents to help cast this movie. And so $50,000 of this film's budget, so literally $50,000 of it, and then you have $300,000 left, I guess. Or no, I can't do math. Oh, wow. So whatever $350,000 minus $50,000 is, okay, there you go. That's the rest of the movie, or that's the rest for the movie. But yeah, so they were trying to find a lead actor to do Mr. Slauson, and this was offered to different people like Jack Palance and Gig Young, but they both turned down the role. And then Chuck Connors, who was the third choice for the production, then accepted this. So that's how he got him. And then according to Schmoller, each of the actors in the movie, aside from Chuck Connors, had to audition for their parts. So Jocelyn Jones was cast as Molly after Schmoller had seen some of her previous performances, while Tanya Roberts was given the role of Becky. And then John Van Ness and Robin Sherwood were given Jerry and Eileen, respectively. And then an unidentified actor named Shalair Kobe is credited in the credits as Davy. So this is like, okay, so the spoiler, Davy and Mr. Slauson are the same person pretty much. And that's that. So actually, and you can see that there's like some influence from like Psycho and also the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and stuff like that. But Shalair Kobe does not exist. This was actually a fake credit that would have had hid the fact that these people are the same person, because it was supposed to be the M. Night Shyamalan, there's a twist, you know, kind of a thing. So yeah, it makes enough sense. So there's that. And then the filming of this movie, so again, they were able to cast it out of, you know, Los Angeles, because they did shoot it around there, and this was all done within Los Angeles County, with additional shots done at Rampart Sound Studios in Los Angeles. This filming started March 27th of 1978, and a portion of the interior shots were shot at an abandoned house that was on Hollywood Boulevard that was scheduled for demolition. And then Schmoller made arrangements with the contractor to postpone the demolition for 5 days, where they were able to then get, you know, footage from there. And by using the abandoned location, the production actually saved like $30,000 in set construction and also soundstage fees. David Wyler, the son of William Wyler, who I guess is a director dude. Let's see who he is. Oh, yeah. He actually was like a very well-known director, I guess. But the son of him was the one who was the second unit director, I think. So coming from a, you know, fancy ass, like, you know, background. And actually the director of photography for this movie is Nicholas von Sternberg, who is the son of Joseph von Sternberg. And that guy is the one who did, he's German or Hungarian, sorry. But he's the guy who did like Blue Angel with like Marlene Dietrich. I know Nicholas von Sternberg because he's the guy who shot Dolomite with Rudy Ray Moore and like Petey Wheatstraw and all that, which I thought was super fun and super cool. So yeah, that's our DP on this movie. It makes total sense. And then production designer Robert A. Burns, who had worked on the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and also The Hills Have Eyes with Wes Craven, he handled the art direction. And also David Schmoller had gone to the same school as Tobe Hooper had done. So, you know, of course, I think that's where some of the influence from Texas Chainsaw came in. And then also, I think J. Larry Carroll was also a little bit of a part of that production as well. So it all comes back to Texas Chainsaw at the end of the day. But yeah, so Robert A. Burns, he handled the art direction, the majority of the special effects, including the mannequin. Americans and their physical manipulations. So to accomplish the poltergeist-like effects, in like the opening scene, the set was constructed at about a rotated 90 degree angle. This allowed for items to be hurled by the crew from the cabinet, which were in fact anchored but to the ceiling, to the floor, which appeared on camera as a wall. And then other special effects were accomplished with the use of wires. So for example, when Tanya Roberts's character dies, a block of wood was taped behind her hair, a knife was attached to a wire which was hurled at the back of her head, which then just struck the wooden block. So she wasn't in danger necessarily. Schmoller has said that he recalled this filming process as being a learning experience, as he was a first-time director, stating in a 2004 interview that he learned a significant amount of, quote, how to work with actors from actress Jocelyn Jones, because I don't think that her and him got along very well. Or maybe I think that was Chuck Connors and her didn't get along very well, but I'm sure she also wasn't afraid to tell David Schmoller what she thought of how she, you know, felt on set or whatever. Because again, I do think there was some tension between her and Chuck Connors, so she, I don't think, was afraid to voice her opinion, it seems like. And then Pino Donaggio was actually in town working on Piranha with Joe Dante at the time that they were doing Tourist Trap. So because Donaggio didn't really speak English very well because he's Italian, but he spoke Spanish, as did Schmoller, the director was able to convince him to also score Tourist Trap, which I thought was really fun and interesting, and why the hell not? But again, it took up like a lot of the budget. So like, you know, that's exactly why like you have what you have when it comes to this. So, but yeah, that's a little bit about the production and then the release of this movie. So it did premiere, like I said, in 1979. And despite its depictions of violence and macabre imagery, the MPAA awarded this movie a PG rating, go figure. And then because of its rating, it was able to have significant broadcasting on syndicated television in the years following its theatrical release. So a little bit about the just like reviews of this movie. So Variety said, quote, although Pick has some appropriately menacing music and occasionally employs some decent special effects, the plot is too loaded with cliches from the concept to individual bits of dialogue to be taken seriously and not silly enough to be regarded as delightfully bad. Charles Champlin of the LA Times wrote that the film has, quote, some moments of effectiveness, but even the hardline chivalrists are likely to feel like it's a long time between streak. Tim Pullian from the Monthly Film Bulletin called the film a, quote, wholly unimaginative exercise in low-budget horror, plunders Psycho for its central plot gimmick in a fashion even more ham-fisted than it is bare-faced. Nothing much is made of the potentially sinister import of the wax dummies, by comparison, by whom the human performers may also fail to come off too well. Ginger Varney of LA Weekly wrote that the screenplay, quote, falls short of perfection, but praised the art direction by Robert A. Burns, commenting that it, quote, mounts sufficient thrills to please even the picky hardcore shock fans. And then it seems like this movie, again, it kind of had like, it was all over the place in terms of just how it was received in all of this. And it did end up getting a release in 1998 on VHS and DVD. It was then released back 2013 by Wizard Entertainment, and then Full Moon Feature actually did the Blu-ray release in 2014, and then they subsequently did the uncut version in 2020 and all that good stuff. So, you know, again, I don't know if it has many like bonus features or anything like that, but they were able to finally get it in its in original form, if you will. And then also I want to kind of talk about the fact that this movie also is like, so, okay, this movie is like, is what it is, right? And it has like Psycho and there's a little bit of Carrie in there, be with the telekinesis and whatnot. But also it's safe to say that like this was also the basis for the remake of House of Wax from 2005. And let me tell you something, I was in the theater for that movie, and it's funny when you watch this film and then you watch that film, which it's been a minute since I've watched House of Wax, really. You know, this film is literally It's like a remake of House of Wax. Like, House of Wax is a remake of Tourist Trap. And I think a lot of people in the horror community would also agree with that because, yeah, it has, like, the brother thing in there. And it has, like, I just don't know if it's, like, a similar story. I haven't seen House of Wax from like the 50s or whatever, but I would venture to say that most likely I don't think we're looking at something that, you know, I think, you know, they were just kind of like, oh yeah, let's just throw these two movies together. And that's what it really feels like. House of Wax is like both really fun and kind of stupid, but like, I don't know. I have a special place in my heart for that because that movie's not as bad as people want to make it out to be. Believe me, I think there's worse movies from that time frame because I was there for it. But yeah, you know, how this movie came about, and I think it's had like a legacy of sorts, you know, and that's cool. And we'll talk about that near the end. But yeah, let's talk a little bit about this plot. So I already kind of gave away some of the stuff anyway, but if you haven't seen this movie, like, you know, don't listen to this until you have watched it, I guess. But yeah, so Eileen and her boyfriend Woody are driving through the California desert. And when their car gets a flat tire, Woody tries to go find a gas station, and their friends, Becky, Jerry, and Molly are traveling in a different vehicle, and they reach Eileen, and they all drive off to try to collect Woody. Woody has found a gas station but appears deserted, and he enters the back room and becomes trapped by an unseen force, and various mannequins appear and cackle at him as objects fly off of shelves until a metal pipe impales and kills him. And then the others come across Slauson's Lost Oasis, a tourist trap. For those who don't know what a tourist trap is, it's just something where, like, it kind of is in the middle of nowhere, and it's something where, like, tourists will maybe, like, kind of stop by and like maybe get like a keychain from, or like it's just like some random ass shit that's like in the middle of nowhere pretty much, that when you're like on, you know, a road trip or something, you stop off at a town. And again, that's what they call tourist trap, these little like roadside attractions. But anyway, back to what the plot is. So their vehicle mysteriously breaks down, and Jerry tries to fix the car, and the girls go skinny dipping, which I'll tell you this much, and I feel like, I don't know if I've said this on the pod yet because I don't know if I've had a movie where I've had to look at it before, but I was just like, listen, no standing water. Like, I'm not, like, you are going to get so many diseases probably. Like, I can't deal with that. So yes, but they do go skinny dipping. Of course, this is a PG movie, so no boobies. But Mr. Slauson, the owner of the tourist trap, he appears holding a shotgun. He seems embittered by the decline of his tourist trap since the construction of a new freeway, and the girls apologize for trespassing. So Slauson offers to help Jerry with the car, but he insists that the group go to his house with him to get his tools. And there they see the tourist trap. So there's like animated waxwork figures. And then Eileen is curious about a nearby house, but Slauson insists that the women should just stay within the museum. Slauson takes Jerry to fix their car, and Eileen leaves to try to find a phone in the other house, since they say, Slauson says that there's no phone in the museum. And then there she finds mannequins, and a stranger wearing a grotesque mask appears behind her. And then various items in the room move on their own accord. Ooh, spooky. And the scarf that Eileen is wearing strangles her to death. Slauson then returns, saying that Jerry drove into town using his car. And when told that Eileen had left, he goes to the house and finds that Eileen has been turned into a mannequin. Very quickly, by the way. But he returns and tells Molly and Becky that he did not find Eileen. And frustrated, the women leave to search for her themselves. And Becky enters the house and finds a mannequin resembling Eileen. And she is attacked by the mask killer and multiple mannequins. And she later wakes up tied in the basement with Jerry. So Jerry says that the killer is Slauson's brother, Davey. Also held captive is Tina, another traveler who is strapped to a table. And she is killed by the masked man, Davey. Jerry frees himself and attacks the killer, but is then overpowered. And this scene was definitely one that I think is like really disturbing and really creepy, because pretty much Davey is talking about how, like, you know, he's putting plaster over Tina's face, and how, like, you know, this plaster burns. things as it starts to dry, and then like you'll start to suffocate, but then you can't really do anything about it, and your heart will burst and all of this. And like I said, I think the atmosphere of this movie overall is very creepy, and you know, I totally think it's crazy that this is a PG movie, because I'm just like, what the hell? Like, there's some creepy shit in here. Anyway, Molly is then pursued by the masked man. She meets Lawson, who drives her to the museum and gives her a gun while he goes inside, and the masked man appears and Molly shoots him, but the gun is loaded with blanks, of course, and the man removes the mask, revealing himself to be Slauson. Dun dun dun. And then Molly is soon captured and restrained to a bed. And then Jerry and Becky, they escape from the basement, but they get separated. Slauson then takes Becky back to the museum. There she is killed by an Indian chief figure who throws a knife at her head, stabbing her in the back of the head. And back at the house, Jerry arrives to rescue Molly, but he has unknowingly been turned into a mannequin. And then Slauson dances with the figure of his wife, because his wife died and I guess made a wax figure of her with her body, I guess. Then Molly sees that the wife has become animated, and then traumatized, she kills Slauson with the axe. And then the next morning, a now insane Molly drives away with her mannequin versions of her friends. We also then find out at the climax of this movie that actually, I guess Slauson had killed his brother and his wife, I guess, because they were whoring around in their house, in his house. And so, you know, can't be doing that. And was kind of bringing up this old, like, Mexican law, I think it is, where if, like, a man finds that his wife is cheating on him, that he can kill her and the guy, I guess, which, again, I don't think he really do that anymore, you know. But it was his legal right, he was saying. So I was like, okay, dude, all right. But you can tell he is one fry short of a Happy Meal, if you will. But yeah, that's the plot, the overall plot of Tourist Trap. Now, I think with this, like, I think a lot of these scenes, the ones that are the most creepy to me are just the ones that I think, like, kind of set this apart from other movies in a way. I would definitely say is that scene with Tina. That's very disturbing and weird and just really creepy, and I think is done very well. I would also say that I think a lot of the stuff with the mannequins, whether it be like when you find that Molly is like strapped to the bed, and then we see that like the there's like this figure who's like, you know, giving her water, but it's like, you know, it's not a real person, but you know, she's starting to go slowly insane. So, you know, that's creepy. There's also this one part where I think it's like the Eileen mannequin or something like that. And it's her and Slauson like sitting down to soup. And like, it's him like saying, you know, oh, you eat your soup. Oh, yes, the soup is very good. Be like, you know, oh, I would like some crackers. Oh, yes, the crackers are very good. And it just makes you feel like, you know, especially with this movie, you're just like, what the fuck is going on? Like, what is this? And so, you know, I think that kind of adds to its sort of weird legacy, or not really legacy, but like its weird overall tone. Again, I think this tone is just really surreal, very odd. And it just kind of goes to, you know, show what you can do with a low budget, especially because, again, this movie does feel it's a little bit of a step above just, you know, shot on video sort of thing. But also, like, you can tell that there was that low budget quality to it, which is fine with me. Yeah, I think if anything, I don't know if there's like any deep like themes to kind of get into with this movie or anything like that. I really do think that you can definitely see a lot of the influences that Schmoller is able to kind of pull from. So like, for example, just the way that like Davey quote unquote looks, very reminiscent of like Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Leatherface in particular. So there's that. And also, like, you know, you have like the window breaking scene as well. That also happened. So there's that. You know, there's just a bunch going on. And, you know, also you have like when I think it's Eileen who goes to the house and she hears like these two people conversing with each other. That's very much like kind of a little bit of a psycho thing going on from what I kind of gather. And again, Carrie really is only from like the score and also just the telekinesis, which again, I think the telekinesis justice is only so much a part of this movie, and I really don't think it like needs to be a part of it really. So I understand, Charles Band, you wanted to put it, make it a little bit creepy, but I also just feel like it doesn't do much for the plot personally. But yeah, I mean, if anything, like, you know, with these characters especially, so we definitely see that like Jocelyn is kind of our final girl, if you will, which again, I don't think that term really existed at the time. And if anything, it's not that she's like, I don't know, like she's not like this, I guess you could assume that she's like virginal, quote unquote, or like whatever other qualities the final girls have, you know, that we see of. But I really just think it's because she also just makes it to the end. But I think her other friends, I mean, like Eileen was just somebody trying to like, you know, they were both her and Becky were in like relationships, whereas we don't know if Molly was really, but you see that if anything, like Eileen is just not really, well, she wants to go see about that other house and she's not following the rules, and that's why she gets killed. And then, you know, even with Becky, she stays for a while. Like, you know, yes, she gets, it takes her a minute to like die in the movie, but like if anything, like she's still kind of fighting back and she's trying to, you know, if anything, still make it through, but then she ends up getting, you know, tomahawk to the back of the head. But you know, I think if anything, like it is that kind of interesting, yeah, it's just that thing of like, I don't think any of these girls are like wholeheartedly bad or anything like that. I think if anything, they're just like, I don't know what I've gotten into, and like now this is like my reality. And the men in this movie also, like the gentleman, so Woody, who is very attractive and has a very nice body, but also like Jerry is also like, there's not much to them in terms of characters. Woody gets off like pretty quickly, and then Jerry is not really, which is just funny because like when I think of Jerry, I also think of like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and then you just hear Molly like yelling for Jerry, so you're just like, oh, okay, we've been here before. But yeah, there's that. And then in terms of like Mr. Slauson, you know, really, I mean, Chuck Connors is such a tall man, and he's also a very handsome man too, at least at this time as well. But you know, him playing this like crazy dude, and really having this kind of dual personality thing going on, I think is pretty successful really. Like if anything, it wasn't maybe seen at that time, or it's not like there was a ton of, again, this is very much from like Psycho, but like, of course it's going to be, duh. But like, I do think that he does a fairly decent job at being able to play these two characters. And I'm sure back in 1979, people's wigs were blown off because they were like, oh my God, it's the same person, you know? So I think he does do a good job. He is very charming when he is just like Mr. Slauson. And even when he's quote Davey, like he is creepy as fuck. Like that character is weird. Like truly. So I got behind it, and I could at least buy into it. So I was down with that. But yeah, and I think, like I said, this movie has had a little bit of a legacy, if you will. I think a lot of people, because they did see this on TV, because it got syndicated a bunch, it was something that you could just throw on and be able to watch. And, you know, technically there isn't anything too violent in it. Although some of these mannequins' heads keep like falling off and stuff, and you're just like, what the hell? But, you know, there is that going on. I think that this movie has had that legacy because of the fact that it could be on TV and it was able to be shown like that. And it is pretty light in terms of that. Yeah, I mean, like, we already talked about how, like, House of Wax is pretty much kind of a remake of this movie, you know, and I don't know why they don't just out and out say that, but you know, it is what it is, whatever. But I do think that they definitely took some from that and throw it in here. I do kind of wish in a way that like Tourist Trap got like a out and out remake, like that's not just House of Wax from 2005, but like, you know, that's probably not going to happen because people don't really go, well, I mean, Tourist Trap still kind of exists, sort of, but obviously we have the internet and we can, you know, kind of have more of this, this stuff won't has happened as much, although people still go missing all the time and people still want to do some weird shit, you know, in the middle of nowhere. So, you know, that fear is always there, I feel like. But that's a little bit about this movie. And really, I don't think I have much else to say about it. You know, if anything, like, it is a movie that I think is a nice example of like an early slasher movie that's coming out right at the end of the 70s into the 80s and done on a low budget. It was all done in Los Angeles, you know, county. So making use of the not just like LA, like downtown area, but making use of some of the woodier areas and stuff like that, which is cool. And then also kind of set up like David Schmoller to be able to then go into working with Charles Banmore and being able to do like the Puppet Master movie, which is really cool. But yeah, I think like if anything, this movie has that kind of weird, surreal kind of atmosphere going on, and it can be very creepy, and it's just kind of off-putting and unsettling, if you will, in a way. Maybe not off-putting, but like it's more unsettling, if anything. And it is something where, you know, I can definitely understand someone watching this and being like, I don't know what the fuck this is, but like I'm kind of into it. Like I like it. And you know, I think you can see influences in other horror movies that come back to this, or even something like, you know, there's, like I said, House of Wax, but also like if you remember like Salute Your Shorts, for example, back from the 90s on Nickelodeon, there was the Zeke the Plumber episode, and literally like Zeke the Plumber and like fucking Davey in this movie don't look that far off, like really. So I'm kind of like, did somebody watch Tourist Trap and like kind of take from that a little bit, you know what I mean? And then also any kind of like mannequin stuff. I mean, Maniac came out like a year after this came out. That movie's fucking crazy, but you know, it just kind of then set off like, yeah, this is fucking creepy mannequin shit, and I would kind of be down for more creepy mannequin shit, really. Not everything needs to be that, like where she's the mannequin and she comes to life and then there's a little sequel. I have not seen those movies, so I don't know what they really are. I just know Kim Cattrall or Kim Basinger, one of those is in it, one of the Kims. But that's a little bit about Tourist Trap, and it is celebrating its 45 year anniversary this year, so I did want to cover it and talk about it as a horror movie. Again, some horror movies, yes, like there are, you know, deeper political meaning, or you can kind of dissect stuff in it, and I'm all about trying to do that. With Tourist Trap, I don't think there's much there, so I wasn't really able to like dig into it, because again, it's just kind of on that surface. But I do think this is a fun little watch, and it's also very accessible because it does have that kind of interesting history of like being a movie that was syndicated. So that means you can find it, you know, pretty easy. Like it's free on YouTube right now. It's also on Tubi in both of its uncut and its cut up form. It's on Shudder as well. I watched it with the Joe Bob Briggs Last Drive-In. So that was super fun to get those little interstitials here and there from that. And I would definitely give this a shot if you've maybe never seen it, or if you're trying to maybe even get into horror, because I think this is a nice little gateway into that. Because again, it's a PG movie. It's not anything that's too like gory and bloody or whatever, but it is unsettling enough that I think that somebody just getting into the genre would hopefully appreciate it, and also just think like, wow, this movie's fucking weird as hell, but I'm still trying to get into it. So that's what I would say to that. But yeah, happy 45th anniversary, Tourist Trap, and you know, we still like ya. I still like ya. I don't know if I'd own you though, but you know, I like that you're around and that you're able to be watched by people, which is nice. You know, that wraps up our episode today. I know it was a little bit of a shorter one, but you know, it is what it is. If I don't have much to say on something, I'm not gonna, you know, keep trying to talk about something if I don't have much. Yeah, this movie's great. You should go watch it, and you know, do the thing. So if you would like to follow the show on social media, you can do so on Instagram at Cult Cinema Circle, and then on Twitter at Cult Cine Circle. You can also follow me on Letterboxd at Jesse, J-E-S-S-E, Kremp, K-R-E-M-P, all one word. You can also email me at cultcinemacircle@gmail.com if you want to give any movie recommendations on the show, give feedback on the show, or if you want to be a guest or anything like that. I'm open to all of it. So please, you know, reach out and email if you want, or just just message me on Instagram. That's also an easy way to get to me. And then on your podcatcher of choice, whether that's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, please give 5 stars and a 1 to 2 sentence review. Gets more eyes on the show, gets more listeners, and it, you know, gets me noticed. So I keep, you know, doing these episodes, and, you know, I like doing them. So there's all that. And then, you know, rate, comment, subscribe on YouTube, because this is on YouTube as well. So if you want to do that. But yeah, that's all about the social media plugs and all that good stuff. So next week, I'm going to be covering a little movie from 1984. So that's what I'm doing. And we're covering a little movie called The Initiation. I'm finally getting around to this movie. So this is a little movie from 1984. It was all shot in Texas. This movie is, you'll hear about it next week, but this movie is a film about a girl rushing a sorority in college, and there's some stuff going on with some childhood trauma she experienced, and there's a killer loose among this, and it's just like a wild ass time. So, you know, be on the lookout for that episode. That's going to be a really fun one. I had a great conversation about that, so we're going to have fun with it. But yeah, that's what you have to look forward to next week. Always thank you for taking the time to listen to the Cult Cinema Circle podcast. And remember, you're so pretty. It's a shame you have to die. Take care. Bye.